Well, it's Mark Burgess here. I'm chairman for Asia for OMFIF, and I'm absolutely delighted to have William White with us today to discuss the COVID virus situation, but also policy more broadly. Bill was previously chief economist of the Bank of International Settlements in Basel from 1995 through to his retirement in 2008. And during that role, as many will recall, Bill was a very significant warner of the dangers of a potential financial crisis. Of course, Bill wasn't done with retirement. From 2009 to 2018, he's been chairman of the Economic and Development Review Committee at the OECD in Paris, a very prestigious position. And fortunately for all of us, Bill continues to be very active as a senior fellow at the C.D. Howe Institute in Toronto, and a very active writer on a range of subjects, including monetary policy and financial stability. Bill's based in Toronto. I'm in Melbourne today. So it's a long distance discussion, Bill, and we greatly appreciate you being on the call. So thanks for joining us, Bill.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Mark. Thank you for the invitation.
I thought I'd start, Bill, with just a quick perhaps recap on the environment that we had prior to the COVID-19 crisis. And you have been warning about the situation inside the economy, even without this sort of significant shock to the world economy. Could you give us a sense for what we're dealing with here in terms of just pre to the crisis?
Well, I think that the problem was that in the decade preceding the pandemic, basically the policies that were being followed, monetary policy in particular, was sort of more of the same that had actually led to the buildup of the crisis in 2008. So that we had another 10 years of ultra easy monetary policy, which in my judgment, very helpful for getting out of the crisis in 2008, 2009, 2010, carrying on over such a long period of time, really resulted in a lot of what I would call imbalances in the economy. Some had been there earlier prior to the 2008 thing, but then they just got worse. And the one example that I would use is debt levels, global debt levels. You know, this is the debt of governments, households, and corporations, non-financial debt. As a ratio to GDP, whereas that ratio had been something of the order of 280% in 2008, by 2019, it was about 320%. So if we normally think of periods of the bust after the boom as a period of deleveraging, in fact, this has been the very opposite. There has been a significant increase in leverage over that whole period. So in a certain sense, it was almost like it was an accident waiting to happen. And it wasn't just the debt that had been sort of getting worse. And in my view, and again, I know this is a rather idiosyncratic view of the world, those ultra-easy monetary policies had actually been contributing more to financial instability than to financial stability. And I could go on and on about how that was working, but let me just make the simple point that financial institutions were having their business model threatened. I heard this over and over again in the decade leading up to 2019. The banks' profits from intermediation were being cut. The pension funds and the insurance companies were in trouble because the interest that they were earning on their assets was too low. So that was a real problem. And then in addition, we had all of this search for yield, which was leading people to do some really silly things. And then finally, when you looked at the way in which markets were functioning, you could see that against the backdrop of this very, very low interest rate environment and quantitative easing and the rest of it, that markets were not functioning the way they should. And we had flash crashes and we had various anomalies in the financial markets. And then, finish with this, in September of last year, of course, we had that breakdown in the repo market in the U.S. Treasuries, which is supposed to be the most liquid and reliable market in the world, with the promise that maybe things would get even worse afterwards, which indeed is precisely what happened when the pandemic hit. So my sense of it, as I say, was that it was really an accident waiting to happen. Something that was a system that was either very vulnerable to an outside shock, which is what the pandemic was, or a system that had been pushing itself to the limits, that it might just have collapsed of its own accord. But I repeat, I thought it was an accident waiting to happen.
So with those shaky foundations, Bill, of course, we've been hit by this surprise that probably none of us could forecast. Perhaps it was a reasonable possibility at some point, but we couldn't forecast. And I know you've done a lot of work on the possible steps here through this next phase, which is very path dependent, but you might just give us a sense for how you're sort of processing how to understand this next phase, and then we'll go back to what the broader implications are once we get out of this situation. So what about those next stages, Bill?
Where do we go from here? Well, one very important point to keep in mind is the economic losses that we're facing right at the moment are not directly linked to the pandemic. The losses that we are suffering at the moment are linked to the lockdown, which is government policy in large part to try to minimize the number of unneeded, unwanted deaths. And social distancing is a way of trying to ensure the reinfection rate of the pandemic is lowered to a level that the hospitals can cope with. So policy, in a certain sense, the lockdown is behind all of this. It really depends in the first instance on how governments will decide to relax the lockdown. And there it's not at all clear what they're going to do because different governments seem to have different priorities about how to do it. Although there's clearly a growing recognition of the fact that the lockdown brings with it social and economic costs that are really very, very large. So we have this trade-off that the government's going to have to make about not overburdening the hospitals, but at the same time being conscious of the need to relax over time. How is it to be done? And we're not quite sure. I think one thing that we can say with almost 100% confidence is this is not going to be the V recovery that people were talking about earlier on that was sort of based on the idea, you know, a little bit like going back looking at earlier things like tsunami or earthquakes or whatever. There was, in fact, a very rapid rebound. I think there's a sense here that it's not at all clear that this will happen in a rapid way. There's a great deal of uncertainty still about whether supply will come back once the relaxation proceeds, whether the economies have been in some sense permanently wounded. Nobody's totally sure about that. And there's also the question of the demand after the relaxation, and nobody's totally clear about that. Because it's all very well to say to people, all right, we can relax now. You can go back to the restaurants. You can fly to wherever you want to fly to. But it's the old, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. If people are still very worried about the prospects of infection, demand may not bounce back in the same way. Now, depending upon the configuration of what really happens on the demand side and what really happens on the supply side, you could find yourself in a deflationary situation, which is where supply comes back, but demand doesn't. Or conversely, an inflationary situation where demand comes back, but the supply doesn't. So there's a huge number of uncertainties here. But I think I would say the only thing that I am pretty sure of is that it's not going to be a V-shaped recovery. And lurking behind the whole thing, too, and again, enormous uncertainties here. All of those things I just talked about, all of those imbalances and the debt overhang and the problems that were there beforehand, it is not impossible that for the economy, those are pre-existing conditions in the same way as heart disease and whatever, pre-existing conditions for people who have a very great problem with shaking off the disease. So the preconditions are actually pretty important in terms of conditioning the outcome. Will they trigger something more serious or not? I think in large part what the governments have done has been to try to take really massive steps, monetary and fiscal policy, to try to prevent that from happening. The trigger turning into a significant downturn, still more significant downturn. But what the outcome is, we're just going to have to wait and see. And nobody really knows.
I think that's a very fair reflection, Bill, and very difficult to forecast. But you have been putting thought into the debt excesses even prior to the pandemic, to what some of the solutions are. So I'm going to put you in a very difficult question here, but how do we unravel it post this? I mean, what sort of processes can we try and adopt? How do we try and fix the imbalances that we've seen and to try and prevent an ongoing problem here?
Well, it is, in fact, I think, Mark, linked to what I've just said. You know, nobody's quite sure how this whole thing is going to work out, and it's going to be the underlying conditions of the economy that will determine whether debt is a problem or whether it isn't a problem, the debt overhang. So let me give you a kind of optimistic scenario, and then I'll give you a pessimistic scenario. I think both of these things are possible. The optimistic scenario is that, in fact, all of this, the steps that the governments have taken and the central banks have taken, do in fact start to bear fruit. Not only is supply sort of more or less intact, but the demand comes back and the economy starts to recover. And in that case, where nominal income is starting to grow, I suspect that the inflation risk will be rather higher, and the governments and the central banks will be a bit more willing to accept some increase in inflation. And the reason why is because inflation eats away at the debt, the real debt servicing requirements over time. This is what we did. In effect, this is what happened after World War I. Now, what has to go along with just nominal income is growing more rapidly is you have to take steps to ensure that the interest rate doesn't go up pari passu with the anticipation of higher inflation and faster growth. This is what happened after World War II. It's known as financial repression. Could you find some way to get the growth rates up, a growth rate of the economy, while keeping the interest rate low and gradually eating away at the debt overhang? I suspect that governments and central banks, if they find that they can do that, will think that it may be the easiest way out of this problem. Now, having said that they might be able to do that, it is also the case that this is still with the optimistic scenario where growth is coming back and inflation is starting to rise. It may also be the case that there are still some risks out there. One of the risks is that you can't, in fact, maintain financial repression in the modern world. I made reference to post-World War II, but those were the days when capital movements were highly restricted. There were all sorts of capital controls. There was the capacity to impose administrative controls, reserve requirements, and all that stuff on domestic economies. And the question is, could the governments do that again? And if they can't do it, because the technology has changed and it's just not possible to have financial repression, then again, I think what you will have is a number of possible risks come out in that story. One of them is that interest rates go up because you can't keep them down. Then a lot of the companies in particular that got big debt problems go under, and then we're back into recession, depression again. Or alternatively, the interest rates go up, but the governments become, as it were, still more tolerant of inflation. And then you could find yourself into a higher inflation environment than I guess people would be very, very happy with. But that's always sort of the optimistic story. Growth comes back and we're all gradually or not grow our way out of it. You can also tell a more pessimistic story, which is one of the economy doesn't really come back. We're confronted with a deflationary situation where the debt problems become even worse. And then it seems to me, even in the other case, I think we should be putting a lot of emphasis on it, but it'll become even more important in a disinflationary environment is that we have explicit means to restructure debts that can no longer be serviced. You know, we need to think much more seriously about restructuring debts, writing them off in that environment, because they will not be repaid. And it's a bit like Bill Rhodes in the old days, you know, with emerging market debts. And he'd get all the bankers around the table and he'd basically say to them, you've got a choice, gentlemen. And they were almost always gentlemen in those days. You can either get 50 cents on the dollar or you can get nothing on the dollar, because 100 cents on the dollar is not on the table. The money's gone. So in an environment where you've got disinflation and a big debt overhang, better to have an orderly, consensual debt workout, consensual between the debtors and the creditors, as opposed to a disorderly workout where maybe the creditors get nothing as opposed to 50 cents. Those are the various alternatives that one can see. But honestly, I think debt restructuring is something that all of us, regardless of the state of the world, we should be more willing to look that beast in the eye and confront it. So that's the situation as far as I'm
I think it's an excellent point, Bill. And As you mentioned, one of the scenarios is for growth to help us out. And we don't have the demographic tailwinds in the next decade, but some of the areas where we do have demographic tailwinds is in the emerging markets. I'm thinking India, Indonesia, Philippines, Brazil, but it's a small group. But they too have problems here. And you were warning, I think, prior to the crisis that the emerging markets too have been partying along and causing imbalances. Where do you see their situation at the moment, Bill?
I gave a presentation at UNCTAD in Geneva in last November, I think it was. And it was in doing my research on preparing for that that I must admit I did get a bit alarmed about what had been going on with the emerging markets. Like you remember in 2008 when the advanced market economies had their big problem. And in a certain sense, in those days, the emerging markets were sort of almost part of the solution, because they still had sort of room for stimulus of various sorts and didn't have the initial problems that the advanced market economies did. And you may remember that China in particular had a massive expansion of sort of quasi-fiscal, mostly done through credit expansion. But they provided a big boost to the global economy. Well, you know, since then, the emerging markets have actually been borrowing in very large volumes. I mean, not all of them, but many of them, borrowing in very large volumes, both from abroad and domestically, as it were, with relatively easy domestic financial conditions. And the buildup of debt in many of these countries and the importation of many of the imbalances seen earlier in the advanced market economies into the emerging market economies indicates that a lot of these guys have got problems now that are very similar to the problems that we've got in the advanced market economies. And I'm thinking, just to use this for example, the shadow banking problems in India, the shadow banking problems in China, the debt overhang in both of those countries, variously public in India and private in China, they've got a lot of problems themselves. And even on the demographics, I mean, I know that there are a lot of countries that are in, I won't say good shape, but let's just say they've got lots of young people, because the other side of that, of course, is the environmental problem associated with continued population growth. But, you know, countries like China, I think the working age population has already started to decline. So the emerging markets have got, yeah, some promise, but they've got a lot of problems. The low income ones, I think the IMF is on record as having said they estimate about 40% of low income countries are either in quote unquote high distress or quote unquote high risk. I think those countries too, particularly the low-income countries, they really ought to have a significant degree of debt restructuring. Restructuring provided hopefully voluntarily by both the public sector and the private sector, not least because if the pandemic really does get going full blast in those countries, they do not have the medical facilities to cope. And far better that the money should be used on ensuring that their citizens have adequate medical care, as opposed to paying on time a debt that they probably weren't capable of paying in any event. So we got some issues there.
Yeah, Bill, I wanted to step back a bit and just talk about policy making generally. I've been in the business now for a long time, CEO of a sovereign wealth fund, but also asset managers. And it struck me in recent years that investors would ask often about whether central banks can protect us in the next downturn. They didn't ask this prior to the 1987 crash, and they got used to it over the following 30 years. It's always worried me that everyone wanted to get the insurance paid in advance without paying for anything. It's built up this kind of behavioral characteristic in policymaking. It seems like, once again, central banks and fiscal have stepped in aggressively to effectively save us in the crisis. Where do we go from here for policy? Where do we go for central banking when we look forward in the next decade? What's the next steps for this sort of policy environment that we've built up over the last 35 years?
Well, you know, Mark, that the biggest mistake I've made in a long professional career was every time there was a crisis, basically saying that this would be the last crisis that the central bankers could get us out from underneath. And I think I said that in the Asian crisis in 1997. And have been proved wrong ever since. And I might well be proved wrong this time, too, that the central bankers, and particularly in association with the fiscal authorities, that they have got the firepower to get us out of this. So, looking back, my track record on this has not been good. Having said that, I just know that the logic of it tells you that if monetary policy is getting less effective with each passing crisis because it works through increasing private sector debt, which then acts as headwinds to slow down the economy going forward, at some point, the headwinds have to get strong enough that it doesn't work at all. And I suspect that we're getting very, very close to that. But as I said before, we'll have to wait and see. They've proved me wrong so many times. The fiscal side, I honestly do think that there is room on the fiscal side for expansion of fiscal deficits, not in the sense that the countries as it currently stands are solvent. Their future revenues will be adequate to eventually pay down the debt. But they have room for maneuver in that I think that the financial markets will cut them some slack, will allow them to run bigger deficits and increase debt levels, debt ratios. Though they've got the patience to allow them to do this for a significant time, and the fiscal authority should probably use that time. Having said that, going forward, anything that the fiscal authorities can do as they practice more expansionary policies to give hope that going forward, when good times return, that the surpluses will be run up in a significant way to get the debt levels back down. Anything that they could do will be very helpful. Now, in a certain sense, all of that is sort of optimistic. Maybe things will work out and we'll sort of go back to something like normal. I think the odds are that that probably won't happen. And if it doesn't, then what will come into question will be the whole way in which the monetary and fiscal authorities, the policymakers, view the world. And I guess my sense of it is that what they have done is they have actually made a sort of a profound, what I would call a philosophical or ontological error. The frameworks that they all use, based on the idea that the economy, the domestic economy and the global economy, is somehow something that can be described in a relatively few simple linear equations that are basically sort of fixed in time and space. You know, that the economy is sort of simple and static. And I think the honest truth is this is a fundamental mistake. The economy is not like that. It's complex. It's adaptive. It's got a totally different nature from what the policymakers assume. And that if we do wind up getting into a prolonged period of difficulties, be more and more of a tendency to say we have to look at the economy in a different way because it leads you to propose different solutions to the problems than the traditional solutions that are premised on the economy being static and simple. So we need a kind of paradigm shift going forward. But of course, that won't happen unless the crisis worsens quite significantly.
Thanks for that, Bill. We're running a little out of time, but I might just get to sort of a simple question that I proposed to you before doing this call, which is if you had the sort of magic wand and could put in some policy tools or some changes, and I know you've talked widely about this, things about, say, executive compensation or the financialization of the economy, but if you had your top three, let's say, things that you wanted to try and change to change the imbalances that have been building over such a long period of time, and we perhaps shouldn't limit it to three, Bill, but what would be on your list? What would be your key priorities to try and change the system that you've been so concerned about now?
Well, the first thing, let's just sort of classify the starting point as the old world. Starting from wherever the pandemic takes us and all of the overhang of debt and all the rest of it. That's the old world. That's the starting point. First thing I'd want to do is get clear in my head where I wanted to go. What's the new world that you think we want to get to? And I think that's totally consistent with recent G20 statements going back for 10 years, is we don't just want a world that's characterized by reasonable growth. We want a world that's more sustainable, and that's got to mean sustainable both in terms of the credit machine that drives the system and more sustainable in terms of the environmental stuff that we've totally discounted in the past. And I think we need a more, in the words of the G20, a more inclusive world, a world in which there will be fewer inequalities and there will be more of a social safety net. Anyway, however you want to do it, you need to have clarity about where you want to go. There's a wonderful old line, if you don't know where you're going, you're going to wind up someplace else. So that's the first thing I'd want to have clarity on. The next question is how you get from where you are to where you want to go. And there it seems to me the question of dealing with the imbalances is something that we've got to deal with. And there I think what that means is we have to have significantly enhanced administrative and judicial means to cut down debt servicing levels, as I just said to you. And I could go through chapter and verse whether you're talking about corporate debt, household debt, government debt, company debt, whatever your leverage of financial institutions, there are impediments to restructuring at all of those levels that ought to be dealt with. And that's the next thing that I would do. Well, the other thing, I guess the third thing I would say is that there are a number of things that have happened during the pandemic that have actually changed the way the world is going to work going forward. And I think we have to look at those things and try to figure out how we're going to deal with them. And there really are quite a number. I mean, what do I worry about coming out of the pandemic? Not least of which is rolling back globalization and the gains from trade. I worry about populism. I worry about threats to democracy. So one, we have to figure out where we want to go. Two, we have to deal with the imbalances that have built up in the past and have been aggravated by the pandemic. Third, we have to get through the shoals, navigate through the shoals of all of the problems that have been set up by this most recent crisis. No one of those things is going to be easy to do, but it can be done if we really put our minds to it.
I guess one of the things that concerns me, Bill, is that the pandemic is perceived to have been a one-off thing that we couldn't anticipate, for example, but that still plays to our worst fears. So we do things like nationalism and lack of global trade, etc. But we don't do the hard things because we perceive that this was a one-off, that it's not enough of a shake to us. Are you optimistic that this might finally get us to make some of those harder decisions, or is it just too hard to tell at this stage?
Well, I think, honestly, it depends on how deep the crisis goes. And the deeper it is, the more likely it is that thoughtful people will be looking at the hard choices. A wonderful line of John Kenneth Galbraith, who says, "Politics is not the art of the possible. It is choosing between the unpalatable and the disastrous." But the real problem is that if the non-thoughtful people turn to simpler answers, like blame the foreigners, that is not going to be helpful moving forward. And on the pandemic thing, by the way, it is becoming increasingly clear, and there have been all sorts of studies on this, this pandemic is not a one-off. We were very lucky to get through SARS and MERS, and now it's worse. But it's entirely easy, entirely possible, and the scientists have talked about this over and over again, that something could come out there that's going to be even worse. So we should be prepared in the same way in advance we should be prepared for economic crises. We should be building up our resources to deal with the next pandemic when it comes, because it surely will.
So thanks very much, Bill. I just have one final question, because I know it's a topic that you've spoken on and something that I feel strongly about, is that the way we teach economics, the way people think about economics, when I learned it 40 years ago as an undergraduate, I was amazed by what the assumptions were, the way the models worked. 40 years later, the undergraduates are still being taught the same things. It seems to me that the financial crisis did see the young students protest about the way economics was being taught. I think that was a positive. Where are we at on teaching economics to undergraduate students? How would you approach it? Because I know you've thought a lot about this, about avoiding silo thinking, et cetera. Now, what should we be doing, Bill?
Well, you know, there is a movement which is called Rethinking Economics, which started at the University of Manchester, which is where I got my PhD, and I've actually been in contact with these folks. And I actually wrote a foreword for a publication that they got out in the Netherlands. This is the Reforming Economics people, Rethinking Economics. And basically, what this book that I wrote the foreword for was, it looked at the undergraduate curriculum in the Dutch language universities in Holland to see whether it was fit for purpose. And the basic message was that it wasn't. And what they said, and I think I totally agree with, is undergraduates should be taught, and this goes back to something I said before, that the economy is a complex adaptive system and that conditions or ought to condition all of the policies that we follow. And I will only mention one of the characteristics of complex adaptive systems is that they always break down according to power laws. And the lesson from that is be prepared. And there are various ways in which you can be prepared. So item number one, the starting point ought to be teach them it's a complex adaptive system. There's no simple answers, although there may be simple principles about how the economy ought to be run. Second thing is we need a much more diversified toolkit to think about how you deal with, or a much more diversified analytical toolkit. You can't just use DSGE type models and think that you've, you know, quantitative methods don't tell you everything. Friedrich Hayek, back 50 years ago, if not longer, basically said the fundamental problem is that not everything that's important can be measured. And, you know, increasingly we're talking about narrative economics, and I think that's basically what we're really trying to get at. There's lots of things that are really important that you can't measure. So we need a diversified analytical toolkit. I think we need to learn about different schools of thought. I mean, when you look back, Austrian theory has got a lot to teach us, and yet it's almost totally disappeared. The new the post-Keynesians, a lot of very good ideas there that nobody ever listened to because they were outside the tent. So I think there's a lot to be said for learning about diversified schools of thought. And very sort of closely related to that, students should be taught what are the practical questions, or how do you go looking for the practical questions, and what can you see in history, economic history, that would give you some guide about what to do and what not to do. So those are the kinds of things that I think undergraduates should be taught. And lastly, they should be taught how to think critically, that you shouldn't just simply accept stuff that you're being taught, that oftentimes arguments are being made on the basis of bogus numbers, faulty analysis, wrong starting points. So a capacity for critical thought is very important. Wonderful line from Cromwell, who I think wrote a letter to the Scottish Parliament. In it, he says, quote unquote, "Brothers, I beg you in the bowels of Christ, think it possible that you might be wrong." And I think that's the kind of thinking that we need to have much more of.
Thanks very much, Bill. The first books I bought post my undergraduate was on bubbles and crashes and et cetera, because I'd failed to be taught that, and I'm glad I did read those early on. Thanks very much for your comments today and your insights into the current pandemic, but particularly framing it around where we were prior, where we have to go in the future, and some of the challenges we face. We really appreciate your time today, Bill. I know that our OMFF members and listeners will be thrilled to go through your thinking today, process it in their own thoughts in terms of the way they see the future, because as you've pointed out, it is uncertain, but it's very clear we've got structural issues to fix as we go along here as well. So thanks for your time today. Very much appreciated, Bill. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And may I say that the questions were wonderfully structured and framed, and it makes it so much easier to give what I hope are sensible answers.
Fantastic. Thanks very much, Bill. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye now.